part of being a big name artist is you have the opportunity to play these corporates and private gigs, which tend to pay a little bit more money. But at the same time, they tend to be a little bit more difficult to play because it's not your core audience. Have to create your own opportunities, but be positioned to take advantage of those opportunities when they present themselves. That would be my biggest advice.
Boy, you talk about the right place at the right time and having the background. Wow. Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is the CEO of BookingEntertainment.com, Steve Einzig. BookingEntertainment.com specializes in booking A-list musicians and entertainers like John Legend, Ed Sheeran, Stevie Nicks, Seal, and Maroon 5 for private and corporate events catering to ultra-high net worth individuals. Not only does the company book music from every genre, but also stand-up comedy and celebrity chefs as well. During the interview, Steve and I talked about how his passion for blues led to a breakthrough label job, the most demanding clients to work for, how the number of hits determines how much an artist gets paid, the most popular music genre for private and corporate gigs, and much more. I spoke with Steve from his office in Los Angeles. I think a big question here is how artists get to do private and corporate gigs.
How they get to do it?
Yeah. So for instance, do you have to break into that somehow? Is it something... Is there some magic formula?
No, because, I mean, what we do is we focus on big name artists. So part of being a big name artist is you have the opportunity to play these corporates and private gigs, which tend to pay a little bit more money. But at the same time, too, they tend to be a little bit more difficult to play because it's not your core audience. So as long as there's a demand for the artist, and it really depends on who is booking the show and who they like. You know, it could really be anybody. Because people have such, you know, wide tastes in music that if they have an act that means something to them, or if it's a corporate event, if it's a certain act that fits a certain demographic, then, you know, they want to hire that particular act. And if it's a well-known act, then they have the ability to play these shows. If it's not a well-known act, then, you know, it could be a cover band or something like that they're just trying to like fill some time. That's not really what we do. So the big name acts, you know, basically get to do it because they are a big name act and people know who they are.
You know, it's funny you just mentioned about how it's a more difficult crowd. I can remember going to a NAMM event, and it was in the Felt Forum, and The Cult was playing.
Okay.
And it was the worst audience, and they kept on saying, "What's wrong with you people? What's wrong with you people?"
Right.
And like no one was responding. And it's like, well, yeah, it's not their audience at all. They just happen to be here.
Right. And that's why it's really important to pick an artist that works for that demographic. And also, part of the reason artists get paid what they get paid is for the number of hit songs they have. So if you have an artist that has, or a band that has three big songs, but you want them to play for 75 minutes, it's like, okay. So after they play for their 15 minutes of their three songs, you got 60 more minutes of them playing filler stuff, which might go over really well for their core audience if the people were buying tickets to come see them, because they might love those songs because they listen to the records, you know, all the way through. But if it's a corporate event, then they're going to say, well, you know, they're going to know the songs that they know, but they're not going to know the other songs. So people tend to talk and maybe go out and smoke a cigarette or whatever. And, you know, there's a cringe factor there sometimes because, you know, you want the artist to be happy. You want the people to be happy. And if people are leaving because it's the filler part of the show, you're like, well, you know,
yeah.
Maybe I should have chosen a better band. But that's part of what we do, is we help people not make those pitfalls. Like, for instance, a band like Sugar Ray, they have their four or five big songs, but they like to do like a 75 to 90 minute set, which is a long set, but they put all kinds of great 90s covers in there. And Mark is really engaging and he really pulls the people in, and, you know, the people really like him. He's very likable. So if they're playing a Beastie Boys song or a Stone Temple Pilot song or whatever it may be, people recognize those songs and love it. It's the bands that try to play like their new material and you're just like, wrong audience, buddy. But I stay away from those bands. And I've worked with so many different bands over the 30 plus years that I've been doing this that I know who are the good ones to go to. Like, for instance, Flo Rida. He's got 10 big radio songs. It's a real high energy show. You know, he's into it. The crowd's into it. You want to bring a party to your event? You book Flo Rida and you're going to have a party, you know, as opposed to even just a concert, you know. And then you have some people who, like, you know, like I said, you know, want to put the filler in there, think that they're playing for an audience that's their audience, and it's not. You have to be real careful with that. for that exact reason.
So why, forgive me for phrasing it like this, but why would a client, corporate client, private client, whatever, not just go to management of an act that they want?
And okay.
Why would they go to you?
Because when you, like, let's say you said, you know what, I've got a bunch of money and I want to have Stone Temple Pilots play in my backyard because that's my favorite band. But maybe you're a bad example, but what does the average person know about staging and sound and lights and how everything has to come together from when the artist arrives in town, let's say the day before, with the ground transportation, the hotels, the green room stuff, the sound check, getting the equipment in, making sure that everybody's on the same page as far as the staging, sound and lights that will fit into that room or that backyard or wherever it may be. There's so many different variables. And truth of the matter is that the average person can't do it without somebody like us. If you know what you're doing, sure, that's great. But if you don't know what you're doing, no agent or manager is going to be like, oh yeah, hey, take this $300,000 band that, you know, makes us a whole bunch of money over the course of the year touring and doing other corporates and privates, and put them in a situation where everything's going to go wrong because the people aren't equipped knowledge-wise to be able to figure out what they have to do to make the show run smoothly. Now, on the flip side, we've done thousands of these, so If somebody wants Dave Matthews to play in their backyard for their, you know, summer party or whatever, Dave's people will be like, yeah, okay, well, we've worked with this company many times before and they booked all of our big acts. So, you know, we would love to, we feel comfortable having bookingentertainment.com take care of that stuff for us because we know that it'll be done right. And then you can take it to another level where, yeah, I can make a little bit more money if I cut corners here and there. But when you're dealing with high net worth clients or big corporations and you're dealing with big acts, if you spend a little bit more money on the little things, whether it's the catering or whatever it is, I think I lost it for a second, Bobby. Sorry.
Yeah, I know. Actually, the beauty of this platform is it keeps on, it's local. It's recording it locally and uploading it. So
okay.
We don't really lose connection here.
Okay, good.
But that said, I didn't get the last part of that.
Okay, well, basically, if you take it to the next level where you go over and above on the catering, on the labor, on the sound and lights, on the bells and whistles, instead of trying to cut corners, then you have a much better show, you have a happy client, you have a happy act, and that is even more of a reason down the road for the manager to be like, oh yeah, we loved working with that company. Of course, you know, we'll trust them with our biggest talent for, you know, their next event.
Yeah. Okay. What's a typical day like for you?
I mean, it could be stressful or it could not be stressful. If you're doing everything that you're supposed to do and you make sure, and this is the other thing too, it's all in the pre-production. You know, everything that has to be done beforehand, if it's all in place and you have my production managers, you know, has everything timed out to the minute as far as load in and labor and power and everything else, and you put everything together, it could be pretty easy. But then sometimes you have something that you can't control, like the private jet for the artist, the door breaks and now they're going to be delayed 3 hours and they were supposed to come in 3 hours early, so now you're cutting it close. Or it could be, you know, the weather, it could be anything. Those are the kind of things that you have to deal with and could add a lot of stress to your day of. But for the most part, you know, we do everything we can to make sure that everything's dialed in to the minute, that everybody has everything they need, and that, you know, everything's going to run smoothly. And then if there's things you can't control, that's when you have to start going into crisis mode and figure out how to, you know, fix it.
How did you get into this, Steve?
Back in college, which was like the late 80s, early 90s, I knew I wanted to go to the music business, and I did everything I could to go work for a record company. When I got out of school, I moved to Chicago and I did an internship for Alligator Records, which was a big independent blues label. Or it still is. And then I came out and I backdoored my way into Atlantic Records through their temp program. When somebody was out for the day, they would have a temp pool. And I was part of that. I took a typing test and I would show up 2 hours before I had to make sure I got the first call. So I ended up working at Atlantic as a temp for a number of weeks. And then I got a full-time temp job where they gave me this blues project that they had that they didn't know what to do with. And I did every aspect of it. I promoted the heck out of it. And I was reading Bill Graham's book, And I was reading, you know, about everything he did in San Francisco and the Fillmore with all those acts and all the acts he worked with and the live side of it. And while I'm sitting in Atlantic, which was really cool, and Ahmet Erdogan would walk by and, you know, Val Azzoli and all these guys, you know, Jason Flom was starting Lava Records at the time. I mean, it was really a cool place to work, but I just still felt disconnected from music. You know, we were selling CDs, we were in an office, it was a corporate job. And I was just like, hey, Bill Graham's life seems a lot more fun than this. And they offered me a full-time job, which I spent 3 years trying to get, you know, while I was in school. And I said, thank you, but no thank you. And I left. And I, 2 weeks later, I was going through this big source book. You probably remember, it was the industry source book before the internet. And there was this promoter that lived like two towns away from me, and it was where his address was. And his name was Richard Nader. He had a company called Richard Nader Entertainment. He used to package together all these acts and put these shows into Madison Square Garden and Carnegie Hall. I mean, real big venues. And he did, you know, big shows, big productions. And I called the number and he answered the phone. And I talked to him for a minute and he must have liked my vibe on the phone. And he's like, hey, what are you doing tomorrow? And I'm like, anything you want. He says, why don't you show up at my house at 7:30, wear a suit. He took me to all his meetings, and the next day I started working for him, and we were doing these shows at Madison Square Garden. I did that with him for about a year and a half, and then I did a show at the Garden with another promoter, which was, you know, gave me a lot more responsibility. I had to deal with the promotion of it and everything else. And then from that, a buddy of mine called me up and he's like, there's this agency looking for an agent. And I was like, who is it? And I had never heard of the agency before, but I figured another person I can meet in the industry, or maybe it's a good thing. P.S. It was James Brown's agency. And I got the job there in 94, 95, I was James Brown's agent. So at the end of that, I had the opportunity to not only do production and concert promotion for Richard, but then I also was on the other side of the phone selling acts to other people who were doing shows like that. And then I was out in Ohio visiting my brother. I was doing a show in Detroit that I had to go cover. And he's like, you know, there's this thing, the internet coming. This was like October 95. And I'm like, what's the internet? He's like, it's like, oh, there's going to be all these computers and they're going to all be connected. And they're going to have these things called websites and people are going to be doing business that way. And people are going to be buying stuff. And I said, well, if this internet thing catches on, that might be a great way for clients to find me instead of me having to find them, because that was always the hardest part. So I was able to take my production experience and put it together with my agency experience and combine it into this turnkey package that we do still to this day, 30 years later, where we provide a turnkey package with everything for one price for somebody to book anybody that they want anywhere in the world. And of course, you know, the internet was a thing you had to learn how to do. I mean, I bought a computer and I made a website, which, you know, I used PageMill 1.0. I had an apartment in the city that cost me $900 a month. And I had no car. I had no cell phone. I had, you know, like two little small bills. So I think my wife and my overhead was like $1,500. I had just gotten engaged. So of course, you know, what do you do when you just get engaged? You quit your job and start a company. So,
wow.
96 and 97, there was really nobody on the internet just yet, but we were able to make good inroads into the search engines because there was nobody on the internet, and I had put all these bios up and photos and stuff. As more people came on the internet, they would link to our site. So we had a lot of like really good links from .gov sites and .edu sites, which ended up becoming very powerful as far as how the algorithms for the search engines would work down the road. And then I just built it from there. You never knew who was on the other side of the phone. And people started, you know, the phone started to ring and people started to fill out forms online really about 98. And then we were off and running.
Hi, I'm Bobby Osinski, and I'm a best-selling author of several books on recording, mixing, and mastering that are considered the gold standard by many. I recently created a new resource for songwriters, artists, bands, and producers, and anyone looking to fix common mixing problems so they can get a better result, stop wasting time experimenting, and not get buried in information overload. I'm calling it the Mix Fix Playbook, 15 quick solutions to common mix problems. These fixes are well known among top mixing pros, but you probably never knew they existed. If you're looking to create mixes that stand up to what you hear on the radio, Spotify, or TV, go to go.bobbyosinski.com/mixfix to check it out now.
Is there a client that you don't like to work with? And not specifically, but like a category of client that you just find they're a pain?
Say the question one more time.
Is there a type of client that you find difficult to work with?
Client, like on the buyer side or on the artist side?
On the buyer's side.
Yeah, I mean, because we work with very wealthy individuals a lot of the time, sometimes their expectations are a little lofty, and they feel like not only are they buying the act for a concert, but the act is working for them that night, and they might make a bunch of, you know, strange requests, or, you know, they want to tell the artist what songs to play and stuff like that. And, you know, the artists don't really want to, some are okay with it. And it's nice to make like soft suggestions, but that would be, you know, certainly the type of client where you have to be careful how you put their ideas in front of the artist, because you don't want to set the artist off and start on the bad note from the very beginning. Or sometimes they want to, you know, play with the artist and stuff like that. And some artists are cool with that, and some artists are not. And then the guys, well, I'm paying all this money, you know, for these guys to come here, so I don't see why, you know, I shouldn't be able to play a couple of songs with them. It's like, you know, they're artists. You're hiring them to play a show, not to entertain your every whim.
Which brings up another question then. I would imagine that normally when you have a VIP section of a concert and you're talking to, you know, people that have paid extra money and sure, to mingle, I would imagine that that must also be part of this, that the client, the buyer, really wants to mingle the artist.
Sure. So that meet and greet aspect of it, normally you just put in the offer. It's kind of just an unwritten rule that there's going to be a meet and greet. They'll try to limit it to a certain amount of time just so that they can not be tortured for a half hour. If it's in fact torture, and it's not always torture, sometimes you can't get the artist out of there because they're having so much fun, because they're talking about stories, and maybe, you know, for whatever reason, then maybe they're, you know, a big fan and they have all these stories. So they'll try to limit it, but very few artists refuse to do a meet and greet. Most are amenable to it, and you just build it into the offer so that you have it, you know, from the get-go. That's really kind of the whole trick to this whole thing, is you want to make sure everybody's on the same page as far as expectations are concerned. And even if there's a big ask in the beginning, sometimes it's easier to ask for it that day of, but, you know, you want to make sure that everybody's expectations are exactly, you know, where they're supposed to be, so that you can have a smooth show and not have some kind of a problem or some kind of disagreement day of.
I was looking at your website, which is very impressive, especially the number of artists, that, not only artists, but comedians and chefs and
sure,
just about every type of act you can think of. I'm curious, what would be the most popular genre of music, for instance, that you could ask for most?
I think, going back to what we talked about as far as artists having a lot of hits that they can bring to the table, certainly, depending on the demographic of the people, 90s rock, bands like Train and Matchbox 20 and Maroon 5, you know, they have so many hit songs, and that kind of meets a demographic that could be a little bit younger and a little bit older. That works really well. And believe it or not, old school hip hop. You know, you can't go to a wedding and not hear Young MC do Bust a Move or Rob Bass do It Takes Two to Make a Thing Go Right. So yeah, whether it's grandma or a 20-year-old, everybody knows those songs. And, you know, they're vanilla songs, meaning they're like middle of the road. So you're not going to offend anybody. And you can really, everybody has a good time. Those really cross over. And it's funny that, you know, that hip hop has become that kind of music. But what we like to do is we like to package together a bunch of those old school hip hop bands. So we'll have Tone Loc, Rob Bass, Young MC, have it hosted by Flavor Flav, maybe throw the Sugar Hill Gang on there. Coolio was great for those shows, you know, before he passed away. And now you have Young MC coming out and doing Bust a Move and, like, you know, two songs. And then you have Tone doing 20 minutes and Rob doing 20 minutes and Flav in the middle. Now all of a sudden you have your 60 to 75 minute show, and there's no fluff. Everybody's doing their hits, and it's a real party. And then we throw Flo Rida on top of that, depending on the budget. And now you have a 2.5-hour party, And Flav tends to do the whole show with Flo Rida because they're great friends. And it's just real cool. We did that out at Dreamforce in San Francisco a couple weeks ago. And it was just, and had a great show. We did it at this place called Bimbo's, which is an old dinner theater. And it has all the crushed velvet. It hasn't changed since the early 50s when they opened it up. And it was just a great night. That also happened to be the night when his plane's door broke. And he landed in Oakland at like 10:20 for his 10 o'clock show. But we stretched it out a little bit. We started a little bit late. And it only ended up going until about 12:30. So we really only behind by about 30 minutes at the end. And everybody said it was the best party that Dreamforce has ever had. So it ended up fine. But talk about a stressful day. That's a stressful day.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm curious. So there's basically two types of buyers. You have the private buyers and the corporate buyers. So how different are they and what their expectations are? Or their wants?
That corporate buyers tend to have more people there. And when they have more people there, you tend to need a bigger setup. So you have bigger sound, bigger lights. Private parties are normally 100 to maybe 300 people, depending on what kind of party it is. So it's a little bit more intimate. So that would be one difference. The corporate buyers tend to be a wider cross-section of people and ages, because you could have younger people at the company or in the industry and older people. Whereas private parties, if it's a 50th birthday party, people tend to be about the same age group, because they're all friends and, you know, maybe some family, but mostly friends. So that makes it a little bit easier to kind of narrow down the type of act that would be good for that demographic. If you're talking about a demographic that's 25 to 60, you know, then it's a little bit more challenging to find somebody really engaging. It also depends on the budget too. You know, if people come to us with a $50,000 budget, you're kind of limited to who you can get. But if people come to us with $1 million budget, then sky's the limit pretty much. And you can, you know, find, you know, that, you know, whether it's Journey or whoever, or the Doobie Brothers or somebody like that, that'll, you know, engage a wide group of people with a number of songs over the course of a 60-minute set. So I'd say that's mostly the challenges of the two. But other than that, I mean, everything else pretty much stays the same. Private parties could tend to be at private homes, especially, you know, people who can afford to do this stuff tend to have big homes. So, you know, the production becomes a little bit more challenging because it's an unconventional venue, whereas corporate events are usually in a ballroom or in some kind of an event space. Sometimes it even comes with staging, sound and lights, which is makes it much easier. But obviously somebody's house doesn't come with staging, sound and lights. So you have to not only get everything in there, but you have to figure out how you're going to get it in, because now you're going into some guy's backyard with basically a semi truck full of stuff. And, you know, if you can bring a stage line stage in there, that's great. But it can be very challenging to figure out how to get everything in there with the space that you're given, being that it's a private residence.
Is that supplied by the act, or do you supply that separately?
No, we supply everything. Sometimes the acts will come in with their own boards and backline equipment because they want to use their own stuff. And it's honestly, it's just easier for them to have a board that's already pre-programmed that they're familiar with. But the staging and the sound and the lights is always brought in by us. And then if they don't, if it's a fly-in date for them and they want us to get them the backline, I mean, it's not hard, but you know, you have to get the backline company to come in with that. And then there's also the dressing rooms and everything else. It has to be coordinated. In a hotel, you can use a meeting space or something like that. But in a house, you know, you have to use the yacht that's parked in the backyard, or the guest house, the pool house, whatever it is. But that's also part of what we do, is we'll go out and we'll do a site inspection beforehand, especially in a private residence. You have to. And we'll take a look at not only how we're going to get the stuff in and out and where we're going to put the stage, but also, you know, how we're going to make the house function as a concert venue for the green rooms and, you know, getting the artists in and out. And if sometimes they're a surprise, actually more often than not. So now you have to figure out how you're going to, you know, hide the fact that there's a band coming sometimes. And we did an event. It was a wedding in Philadelphia, and it ended up going viral. They had Tim McGraw sing My Little Girl for the father-daughter dance, but the bride had chosen that song having absolutely no idea that her father had booked Tim McGraw to sing it. So he was cool as a cucumber. He gave his speech, and he, you know, I don't know how he did it. And the way that we had it set up was that he had her dance with him with her back to the stage. And the band that came out wasn't the cover band that was playing the party. It was Tim's guys, and Tim was off stage. So when he started singing in a wireless mic from off stage. And as he walked on, the crowd, of course, realized it was him and went nuts, but she didn't even know yet. And then the father spun her around as Tim came to the front of the stage. And then Tim actually came out onto the floor and sang it from 5 feet away to them dancing. It was an incredible moment. Yeah, she had got picked up by Good Morning America and CNN. If you go online and type in Tim McGraw wedding in Philadelphia, there's all kinds of stories on there. They had to get a publicist after the wedding because they got so many inquiries because it had gone viral. Because it was such an incredible, incredible moment, which was amazing.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. Do you go to all the gigs?
I don't go to all of them. I have people working for us all over the country, but I do go to, you know, a number of them. And I mean, If my agents, if it's their client, they usually go cover the those shows. We tend to also swap things out. If I have an agent on the West Coast, if the show's on the East Coast, it's easier for me to go cover it. So I'll go do that. But I go to certainly, you know, the big ones and anything that has to do with, you know, my personal clients that I've collected over 30 years.
I'm curious about chefs. So who hires chefs?
Chefs are funny. Back during COVID, it was very easy for a company who couldn't collect a whole bunch of people together to have a chef do a custom presentation specifically for their people. So they would mention the company beforehand, anything specific about the company, do a little cooking demonstration. And, you know, they would then give that. That would be part of a thing that only the people from that company were able to see. Then you have people who have parties and maybe they have 40, 50, 60 people at the party, and they want to hire a famous chef to come in and oversee the meal preparation and the menu for that kind of stuff. And then, you know, they can also come out and do a meet and greet with the guests, or maybe, you know, speak for 10 minutes or something about the meal or their history or whatever it is. Chefs are celebrities, just like, you know, rock stars and comedians and singers. So if you can have Martha Stewart, you know, come to your event, there's a wow factor to that. And then you can also have the meet and greet aspect of it, like we talked about before, so people can take pictures with them. So, you know, there's a celebrity factor to them. It's not just about the food. But during COVID, we did a lot of those presentations, and it was really great for everybody.
So less so now then?
Yeah, because everything was virtual during COVID.
Yeah.
So now you don't have to deal with that. But it was really the only option you had. So these companies that had these big marketing budgets that were already allocated for 20 and 21, you know, they had to be creative in what they did, not only how they spent the money, but how they engaged the people who they were responsible to bring together. So these were great opportunities. We did a lot with music, too. You know, we were teaching the bands how to do these types of shows, because sometimes they would rent the sound stage and it would be in a controlled environment, so they would do it that way. But sometimes these guys would be at their house and they had to figure out how to put a song together that was cohesive, but all the people were recording their sections at different times. So they would use click tracks, and, you know, the drummer would lay down the drum groove and then he'd send that to this guy, and, you know, the bass player would play along with that and then he would put that down. But as long as they had the click track, everybody was on time. And then you would just, you know, they'd put the song together, and really it's like making an album, you know, and making a single, but it's really their show. So they had nothing else to do. So they had plenty of time to do this. But we did that with a lot of acts and a lot of, you know, it was really, really successful. And it was obviously, you know, wonderful to have that kind of income during COVID when everybody wasn't able to leave their house and wasn't working, especially the live entertainment industry.
Getting back to the chefs, I was thinking, okay, so are they hired to cook for these people or what?
Yeah, sometimes they are.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, yeah. They'll cook. You know, if there's 50 people or whatever at the event, the chef will come in and be responsible for the menu. We can set up a whole, you know, cooking area, and they come in. Now, they're not really there, you know, breaking eggs and cutting celery, but they have all their people there. They create the menu. It's up to their standards. And it would be as if, you know, you were eating at their restaurant. You know, they're not, yeah. They might be in the kitchen a little bit, but, you know, they're really just responsible for the level of cuisine and the ingredients and the recipes.
Wow, that's very cool.
You must be
remember reading. No, I well, yes, a little bit, but I was remember reading a book from Shep Gordon, the manager. His manager originally for Alice Cooper, but his claim to fame was elevating chefs their visibility. He was kind of the first one to see that, oh, sure, these guys are celebrities as well. So we started to manage a bunch of them, and at least he took credit for doing that. I don't know if that's the case or not, but he took credit for it.
Certainly television shows like the, networks like the Food Network and stuff like that have done a tremendous amount to elevate these chefs. I mean, you'd be surprised. These guys can get $75,000, $100,000, $150,000, and then it's the cost of all the food and everything over and above that is also taken care of. So, depending on who it is, they can make a lot of money. And sometimes they don't even have to cook. Sometimes it's really, could be a question and answer. It could just be, a lecture. It could be things having nothing to do with food. So there's a lot you can do with chefs.
Very cool. You lead an interesting life, Steve.
Yeah, you have no idea. That's one reason why I decided I wanted to do this. And it's because, I was in Chicago over the weekend, and, I took my son with me, who's 22, and he's been, helping me out with some of the shows. And I mean, we spent the whole day Friday running around Chicago to every blues club and, fun restaurant. Saturday, we did the show. I like to play poker. So, I travel all over the place, and I can usually find some place where there's a good poker game, whether it's legal or, underground.
And, right.
It's fun. I tend to try to, I'm 54 years old. I've been doing this for a long time, but I can still do a good 24, 36 hour run and no sleep if I, have an opportunity to go out and do the show, everything else, and then maximize my time away to enjoy New Orleans or Chicago or Paris or whatever, wherever the show may be. I'm one of those I'll sleep when I'm dead kind of people, and I'm pretty good at it.
Enjoy it while you can do it.
Yeah, it's a little bit harder, but it was never really that hard. So now if it's a little bit harder, it's still not too bad.
Yeah, I got to the point where I did that most of my life, and I got to the point where it's like, I don't think I want to do this anymore.
Yeah, I haven't gotten to that point yet. Yeah. Not yet.
All right, Steve, last question.
Sure.
And thanks so much for doing this.
That's my pleasure.
I really enjoyed speaking with you. What's the best piece of advice that maybe somebody gave to you or you learned along the way?
I would say the best piece of advice would be obviously to do something that you love. I mean, they say if you do something you love, you don't work a day in your life, which I think is true to a point. Obviously there's lots of hard days that come from, doing this and everything else. But, I just set a goal for myself and I just put everything I could into it. And I was able to get there. I was very fortunate, but I guess the advice would be you have to be in the right place at the right time, but you have to be able to capitalize on that situation when it presents itself. And a lot of times that situation doesn't present itself. You have to make it happen yourself. And being thinking out of the box and getting out of your comfort zone and, going to places you wouldn't normally go and doing things you wouldn't normally do. Sometimes those are the opportunities that present themselves that you never would have found. When I was in college, I took a trip to Mississippi. Obviously, I play guitar. I've been studying blues for 35 years. And my spring break, my senior year in college, everybody was going to Jamaica. And I decided I was going to go to Memphis and spend the week in Memphis. And I really didn't even know why I was going. Obviously it was for the blues. And, I wanted to really immerse myself in it. But then I saw the sign that said Highway 61 South. And I was like, I got to do that. And then I didn't realize Mississippi was like only 15 minutes away. So now I'm in Mississippi. I ended up in Clarksdale. I ended up meeting these two people who one gave me a guitar lesson and the other one ended up being, he was a musician who I met there. And then I moved to Chicago and the combination of the two things, when I worked for Alligator, I worked in every department. Now, when I got there, Bruce Iglauer, the president, was like, how many days a week are you going to work here? I'm like, five. He's like, and I was getting paid. He's like, full time. I'm like, yeah, this is what I'm here to do. And he was amazed by the fact that I moved all the way from New York to Chicago to not get paid for an entire summer, to basically, do whatever they wanted me to do. But those kinds of taking that kind of initiative creates opportunities. So now I came out of Chicago. I had, all that experience working at that label, plus everything I did in college and the trip to Mississippi. When I get to Atlantic and I'm trying to figure out my place there, I'm talking to everybody I can. This one woman is like, hey, you know, we have this blue, this project. We don't know what to do. Dave Stewart from the Eurythmics went to Mississippi and made this basically field recording documentary film. And the soundtrack for the film is the first thing he's releasing on his label here that we thought he was going to be giving us all these alternative acts, but he's giving us these hardcore North Mississippi blues acts that, like, we have no idea what to do with it. And do you know that the guy who gave me a lesson when I was in Clarksdale was on the record? He was one of the seven musicians that was part of this movie. And that and my trip to Chicago and everything else made me fully qualified to be able to have the opportunity to promote that record. And that record was called Deep Blues. And I guarantee you, if you go talk to the guys from the White Stripes and the Black Keys, that movie, without that movie and me promoting the hell out of it, those guys never would have happened. Definitely the Black Keys, because the first record the Black Keys had, they did a whole recording of R.L. Burnside songs. And R.L. Burnside was on this documentary, and nobody really knew who he was. And I say I promoted that record, I mean, and this was before the internet, there was not one corner of the country that I could have sent one more CD to and one more movie poster. I mean, I promoted it everywhere. Even Dave Stewart said in an interview I was listening to, it was on a podcast, and he's like, yeah, you know, we did this record called Deep Blues. He's like, Atlantic didn't really promote it very well. He's like, but everybody knows about it. And it's like, well, of course, you know, how do you think everybody knows about it? I wasn't dealing with him directly, but I had to create those opportunities, and those opportunities became the milestone opportunities for me to move forward in my career. So, you know, you got to get out there. You have to create your own opportunities, but be positioned to take advantage of those opportunities when they present themselves. That would be my biggest advice.
Boy, you talk about the right place at the right time and having the background to do that on top of that. Wow.
Yeah. But you know, what was I doing in Atlantic? You know, I was backdooring my way in there through the temp agency. You know, you got to think out of the box. That's the other thing, too, and reverse engineer everything. How do I get a job at Atlantic? I have to be in there. How can I get in there without, you know, getting a job through the regular interview process? Well, the temps go right in. So if I could be a temp, then I'm in, and then I can start to network and do what I have to do. And I literally called Atlantic Records. I remember it was like 212-475-2000. I got the switchboard. I'm like, hi, can I get the temp agency, please? They're like, hold. And I said, who runs a temp agency? They're like, Virginia Fernandez. I'm like, great. Can I have her office, please? And they forwarded me to her. And I said, you know, I'd love to come in for an interview. I'm looking to be a temp, but I really want to work there. And I promise you, I'll do everything I can, you know, to do the best job I possibly can. And I took the typing test. They gave me the shot, and boom. But I had to create that opportunity. Nobody came to me and said, you know, here's a job at Atlantic Records. I had to, you know, manifest it. And that's definitely the most important thing.
Very cool, Steve. That's a good place to stop, I think.
Cool. Well, thank you. I really appreciate you taking the time. And I look forward to seeing this and watching some of your other podcasts as well.
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news, and find out about openings for my latest online classes at bobbyosinski.com. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.